McCarthy did not start what we call McCarthyism. He doesn't even deserve whatever honor there would be in that. He really was a Johnny-come-lately. He jumped on the bandwagon. And here, if you'll excuse me for a personal touch, he didn't even wave that laundry list or whatever it was that he said had the names of 200 and some card-carrying communists in the State Department until 2 weeks after my conviction. He was very careful to wait until he saw what was good politics and what wasn't. The House Un-American Activities Committee had started long before him, and those of you who have been studying the 30s and 40s know that Martin Dies started it way back in the 1930s. I was and am an unreconstructed New Dealer. In those days, we left at Dies, but I'm afraid he and some of his friends had the last laugh. We couldn't believe that the American people would take seriously the kind of charges that Elizabeth Dilling, in a book called The Red Network, which listed Mrs. Roosevelt and various other people as dangerous Reds. Couldn't believe the American people would take them any more seriously than we did. And I think our judgment was correct in the long run. But we do have an unfortunate strain in our history. I won't try to make it a medical analogy by saying there's something in the genes of the American political system which brings out a tendency toward scapegoatism when we're under tension. But it is a fact that we are different from other countries in our history in the number of times this has happened, going back to the Salem witchcraft trials. Then even in the great days of the founding fathers, they were still around, when the beginning of the 19th century, the Alien and Sedition Acts were passed. The witchcraft people were afraid of witches and devils. Those who passed the Alien and Sedition Acts were afraid of the revolutionary concepts of the French Revolution, which came a little later than ours, and I suppose we didn't want anybody to update us. But it is strange that the American, young American nation, founded on its own revolutionary act, should have got so uptight about things that Thomas Paine really thought he had carried to the French as much as the other way around. Then in the mid-19th century, we had the Know-Nothing Party and Know-Nothing Hysteria, where the enemy, the danger, was supposed to be Roman Catholics. And in this century, as a result of the tensions following, I suppose, any major war, the tensions following World War I resulted in what are known as the Palmer Red Raids. There, the fear was of largely imaginary anarchists and bearded Bolsheviks. It was used certainly to dampen militant activities in the unions, which had been given greater power during the war than they had been accustomed to before. In that sense, McCarthyism looked as though it was simply following a graph in American history. I attended about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, a seminar that Fred Friendly, who is now teaching at the Columbia School of Journalism, had on the McCarthy period. He had shown that marvelous statement that Ed Murrow, with whom he used to work, had done bravely attacking McCarthy. To his surprise, most of his students, graduate students, hardly knew the term, or if they did, they didn't really know what it meant. One young man, who was a New Yorker, whose parents, he said, were intellectuals, had never even heard the term. What puzzled them most after they got to know something about the period from the seminar that Friendly was running, together with a young British historian named Michael Wood, was how it could have happened. What caused it? And their second question was, will it come again? I'm not sure that I have time this evening to go into all the causes of why it came. I'm pretty sure that one essential cause was the confusion in American thinking when, after seeming to have won at great cost a major victory, the people were suddenly presented with what I hate to call a scenario, with an allegation that we had a new vast enemy, the Soviet Union, and looked at in with any perspective, I think we should have realized even then that when empires disappear, which certainly happened both in World War I and particularly in World War II, that a vacuum of power occurs in various places in the world. And the tendency of great powers is to move in to fill the power vacuum, so that a confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States was, to my mind, inevitable. One can say that if President Roosevelt had lived, some of the spirit of Yalta might have continued. I doubt it. I think that the confrontation that did come about probably had to occur. That certainly, in my opinion, was one of the major causes. When the public as a whole suddenly found that victory, which they had earned in a very difficult war, didn't mean victory, that they had to gird themselves for a new possible encounter, and further believe that there were domestic adherents of the enemy, this was very frightening. As a member of the State Department at that time, I was conscious of one thing that I think made the whole thing unreal. I didn't know anyone in the State Department that genuinely feared anything like either a direct test of arms with the Russians, or certainly any danger, direct danger to us, and particularly no danger of an invasion of Europe. After all, General de Gaulle was a lot nearer to Red Armies and a lot more likely to suffer had there been an actual invasion, and he didn't have any such fears. What was feared, and I think this is important to clarify the picture, what was feared was the rise of a number of socialist communist, or semi-socialist states and governments in Europe, throughout Europe. Those of you who are studying history, European history of that period, know that there was a strong movement in France. Signs were painted, Yanks go home. It was a period that lasted for at least 5 or 6 years and came to a head in 1950, just before McCarthyism itself became most virulent, when the communists might very well have got something like 30-35% of the votes in Italy. It was a period of great political uncertainty and instability. If you read the official announcements of the time with care, I think you will find that there was no express statement by our government officials, there is a danger of an invasion of Europe. But certainly the public got such an impression. It was known that the public was getting such an impression. and those who allowed it to come about didn't feel greatly disturbed that that was the reaction. On the contrary, they found that rather a helpful reaction. I remember an incident about 1946 or late 1945 when Dean Acheson, it seemed to me, was, and the department as a whole, overstating, and seriously overstating, the kind of danger I've been referring to. There had been immediate public demand for the withdrawal of American troops after the war, a natural feeling if one has won a war, let the boys come home. And when I expostulated mildly, Dean said, yeah, but we have to frighten Congress. If we don't scare them, he said, they'll go fishing. Dean was very good at accepting wisecracks as well as making them, and I thought I was being moderately humorous by saying, but Dean, if you do scare them, they'll go crazy. He didn't think it was funny. But I think, in a sense, this is what did tend to happen. But the real hysteria was not so much in Congress as in the public at large. This, I think, was at the root of McCarthyism. Now, the question of how it came to an end, and I would like to think that, again, the medical analogy, that the fever ran its course. Actually, it was, I think, due to considerable courageous resistance, but also building up a sense of ridicule. The one thing that demagogues apparently can't stand is ridicule. When people are under severe pressure, on the other hand, it's not easy to rely upon a sense of humor. And McCarthyism did vast damage. People were discharged from universities, from high schools. They were driven out of publishing, certainly from the air, and almost every area of leadership and communication. A friend of mine has said that the elimination of so many people who knew about the efforts of the New Deal, and I think one of the purposes of McCarthyism was to discredit Roosevelt indirectly. He was too popular for them to attack him directly, but by attacking people who had worked with him, it was a means of attacking the New Deal indirectly. This friend said that because of the driving out of government, positions of influence, those who had participated in and lived in that time, the whole Roosevelt area became a hole in history for a lot of people. Now, those of you who are studying history become familiar with something, I suppose Charles Beard was once called a revisionist, but never on such a scale have young scholars been busy revising and re-examining establishment history in this country. And I think it's high time. I guess I could claim to have been a premature anti-revisionist when I felt that the Cold War was getting out of bounds, the whole McCarthy syndrome before there was a McCarthy on the horizon. So that I went, as Professor Pollenberg said tonight, to the Carnegie Endowment, feeling there was no place I wished to be in the government under those conditions. But similarly, the New Deal, at least we younger fellows, were premature Nader's raiders. It took a totally different context for some of the enthusiasm and idealism of the New Deal to be recognized independently. There was no sense of continuity. Nader seemed like a totally new phenomenon. Now, a word or two about the courage of those who resisted, and particularly those who relied on ridicule. Most of the names that I will mention are probably not known to you and won't be in the history books. A man named Minns, M-I-N-S, was accused by McCarthy after he came to the scene. A formal hearing, public hearing, was to be held. He had as his lawyer a man then not so well known, whose name you will know, Leonard Boudin. And Leonard said to his client, also named Leonard Minns, "Wasn't your wife a Latin teacher? Wasn't she blacklisted?" Tonight, before the hearing, there's only one thing I want you to do. They're not interested in facts. We have to meet them on a different ground. You spend the evening, and anyway, it'll keep your mind off your anxieties tomorrow, going back through the Latin classics written at the time of the collapse of the Roman Empire. He said, "I've forgotten much of what I read, but I'm pretty sure in Tacitus, Suetonius, and some of the others of that period, there are phrases like, the walls have ears, every man was set against his brother." And what I want you to do is to find, say, 15 good quotations like that. Type out about 25 copies of each of them on a separate slip with the citation in Latin, and then clip to that a translation. They had no idea why they were being given this chore. They really thought it was to keep their minds off their troubles, but they were very conscientious, and the more they worked at it, the more they found it rather grim to think that some of the statements they were writing out were all too applicable to the world they were then living in. In the morning, they handed their night's work to Leonard, who distributed them around at the press table, even before the pressmen came in. He said, "One other thing. When you appear, be very respectful to the chairman, Joe McCarthy. Ask him if he would mind, since you're sure that he is familiar with the classic tongue, you're occasionally speaking in Latin. He will surely fall for it. He's very vain, and his early training was supposed to have included some knowledge of Latin." And it worked just that way. McCarthy was very pleased to have the respectful attitude and the flattery. And the first statement read out in Latin, nothing much happened. McCarthy grinned as though he understood every word of it. But the second one, one of the newspaper men decided to look at this funny little pile, and he nudged the man beside him. Pretty soon, about the third, there was a ripple of excitement at the press table. And the fourth one, there were giggles. And McCarthy noticed it and was disturbed. And the next time there was a guffaw, he was absolutely at a loss. He suddenly decided something terrible had happened, such as his fly being open or something. And he dismissed the witness. Now this took thoughtfulness, this took care, and courage, because it might not have worked. Then, I'm sure you do know about Lionel Stander, who had quite a career as a character actor, and who had a voice that wouldn't need the mics tonight. Very gravelly and powerful. When he appeared, he was asked if he would be a friendly witness, and he said, "Well, I don't know what that means." And they said, "Will you name un-Americans?" "Oh," he said, "of course I will." He said, "Every one of you up there." Again, he was excused. And then there's the story of Zero Mostel that you may have heard. Zero had been blacklisted, and during that time, he earned his living as a painter. He's quite a good painter. In fact, he thinks he's a better painter than an actor. He says it's terrible people won't pay him as much for his paintings as they do for his acting. Zero, I think, had a different lawyer, but an equally canny one. And Zero The committee never heard of him. Zero began in a very soft whisper. So he were a very timid little man, and big man. And they kept saying, speak up. Can you hear me now? They said, louder. And suddenly he let go the rhinoceros roar, filling the whole room full of double talk. And they realized they'd been had, and he was excused. Now, I don't want you to think that McCarthyism was all fun and games. And I want to emphasize that the virus isn't completely dead. There are signs that, though from a different point of view, a different perspective, some of it will be raising its head again. In the New York Times, hardly a radical sheet, two or three weeks ago, there was a long article headed Radical Economists Under Fire. And the gist of the story is that half a dozen younger economists, all teaching, California, Massachusetts, particularly California, they seem to go in for a strange kind of revivalism of peculiar practices in California. Have been denied tenure. Now, that's not quite as bad as what McCarthyism was doing. The basis of the objection is that they are embarrassing to their institutions, all of which are partly dependent on state grants, and legislatures are not uniformly filled with angelic souls yet. There is an embarrassment to any educational institution during a time of depression, when funds are difficult to obtain and shrinking, if voices are raised on its faculty which are critical of the very hands that feed the university. And this is embarrassing. On the other hand, the tradition which McCarthyism itself attacked is the tradition of freedom of thought, freedom to teach, and freedom to learn. So that the kind of pressures which are not due to Cold War confrontations today, they're due simply to dollars and cents. But there is a temptation in this country for demagogues to tend to pick scapegoats, and each of these economists is at least socialistic, if not a full-blown socialist. Some of them call themselves Marxist, but there are a lot of varieties of Marxists. There were many dissenting chapel sects in England at a time when the established church was very much annoyed with them, and I assume that the established church of Marxism probably isn't happy about all sorts of varieties of Marxist teachers. But on the other hand, it is a subject that certainly has been studied in Europe for a long time, and no reason it shouldn't be studied as long as other points of view are expressed. There's absolutely no reason. But this may not appeal to legislators or to trustees or to donors. So I would want to emphasize that, of course, there's a danger that these unhappy practices of the past may come again. They do not depend on the charisma of an individual demagogue. Joe McCarthy had very little charisma. I met a man only three or four weeks ago who said that his father had been a tailor in the town where Joe McCarthy lived in Wisconsin, when McCarthy was a local magistrate or judge. He said that his father was terribly respectful of all learning and education and of authority, and particularly of the judiciary. Therefore, initially, he was very flattered to have McCarthy as a judge, justice of the peace, come into his shop. But that McCarthy had been so unpleasant, so difficult as a human being, this was long before he became a senator, that his father had said, "Don't come in my shop again." Then this was countered by another man who had known McCarthy. He said, "Oh, I knew him when he was called Coconut Joe out in the Pacific. He later appeared as a hero, but he never flew. Whenever the planes were to take off, he was sick or he couldn't be found, and they said he must be up in the trees collecting coconuts." Called Coconut Joe by his squadron. He was really not a man of charisma. It doesn't take a skilled rapscallion in order to capitalize on the kinds of fears I'm talking about. But it does take a rather bumpkin electorate. And this I find we don't have anymore. I'm from Baltimore. When I was in college, Henry Mencken was a big factor in my life. And Henry Mencken spent his time talking about the bourgeoisie. I grew up believing there were a lot of them, and maybe they were. I remember for a while, Mencken had a lot of fun with all of us. He wrote a series of letters to the Baltimore Sun, signed "An American Mother," protesting about the nude statuary in Walter's art gallery. Well, this caused marvelous excitement for the Sun. I don't think they knew Mencken was doing it. "An American Mother" thought that this was bad for the young, licentious, libidinous, and various professors at my university, Johns Hopkins, various art curators replied in high dudgeon. Finally, Mencken capped it all off. "An American Mother" said, "These people may think there's nothing to what I'm saying, but when my teenage son came home last week, he said, 'Say, Mom, them gals sure look good to me.'" I don't think the kind of people Mencken was worried about are by any means as dominant in the American electorate today. And I think one reason is the tremendous increase in education. When I was in college, and I'm told the statistic I rely upon is an overstatement, but the statistic that I came across was that of those of college age, 18 to 22, 17 to 22, regardless of qualification, regardless of financial ability, just the total number of people in that age, only 15% actually went to college. As I say, I'm told the figure really is nearer 12%. And remember, at that time, the total population of the country was only about 130 million. Today, the figure, the percentage, is 45%, much closer to 50, I'm told, even than the 45 that was true 4 or 5 years back. And that applies to the age group I'm talking about in a population of over 200 million. So we're talking about a vast increase in education. It's been going on ever since the war. It's not just the number of young people in colleges today, it's people who've been in colleges from 46, 47 on. That's a very large number of people who have been subjected to sophisticated examination of historical facts, of historical events, of patterns of politics, of thought. I just don't think that it's going to be easy to either bamboozle or stampede or turn into hysterics, a sufficient number of the American electorate today to make McCarthyism likely. I wish I could be more confident, because George Wallace seems to be doing fairly well with some elements. Let me refer again to the fact that McCarthy really had no charisma. I think Dean Acheson put it best. Dean was a bit more florid than I think is quite customary today. But he said, Joe McCarthy was a low, mean scoundrel. To denigrate him is to praise him.